The title of this talk is Improving Software Architecture Competence, and I'd like to spend about an hour or so or less talking to you about a new project at the Software Engineering Institute, which is, of course, Improving Software Architecture Competence. On slide two, you can see that the talk is going to come in four parts. There'll be a short introduction, and then parts two and three will talk about two different models we're pursuing of architecture competence, and we'll try to understand what that means and what we can do with those models. And then part four will be a short set of conclusions. On slide three, you can see that software architecture has, I think, ascended over the past 10 to 12 years to a point which it was not enjoying 10 or 12 years ago. It has emerged, I think, as the prominent paradigm in large system development. It is inconceivable, unimaginable, that people would build systems these days without considering what the software architecture for those systems should be. And in practice, it's achieved that level of prominence, but also in the surrounding areas, it's also achieved prominence. There are worldwide conferences devoted to it, books devoted to it. There's a picture of one I just happened to choose completely at random. No idea why that particular one came up, but there you go. There are defined architect roles in organizations. I think that's very positive. There are courses and training for it. Professional organizations supporting it, such as IASA, and journals dedicated to it. Software architecture is a very important field of study these days. Next. And I think the rise of software architecture has resulted from two trends. One is the recognition of the importance of quality attributes. For me, the importance of software architecture is about the achievement of quality attributes in a system, such as performance and security and availability and so forth. Without the architecture supporting those things, it's very, very, very unlikely that the system is going to have the quality attributes that you want, and if it doesn't have the quality attributes, then you're incubating a disaster. The second reason I think software architecture has ascended is that we are building very large and very complex systems today. I think the history of software engineering can be viewed as a ever-increasing upward spiral of complexity, where our language for expressing what we want the computer to do becomes more and more complex and represents more and more sophisticated actions. Decades ago, our primitives used to be things like square root, and now our primitives are things like online e-commerce auction. The complexity of the primitives has gone up a lot, and we're building very big systems these days, and software architecture is necessary to coordinate the construction of those very large systems and to make sure it meets the goals. Next. Before I go any further, I'd just like to tell you what I mean by software architecture. I'm not pedantic about definitions. I don't claim that this is the only one or the absolute right one, but I like it. We like to say that software architecture is the structure or structures of the system. These structures comprise software elements, the externally visible properties of these elements, and the relationships among them. I like this definition because it lets me do with architecture some of the things I want to do with architecture. It lets me go into an architecture and analyze it with respect to system properties. It respects the fact that software has many structures that it comprises. And no one structure can be the architecture, and this leads to the multi-view treatment of architectures, which I think is present in most modern treatments of architecture documentation and construction. Each one of these structures can be engineered by the architect to deliver quality attributes. These structures can be runtime or non-runtime. They can be constructed as patterns or styles. And so this is what I like to say is software architecture. If you come to the SEI website, you can see that we collect definitions of architecture. The last count we had, I think, 150, 160 definitions from 22 countries around the world. And you might be interested to know that after the U.S., the country that gives us more definitions, that contributes more definitions to our website than any other, is India. So we're really, really happy. I love checking my mail and getting a new definition from somewhere in the world. Next slide. On slide six, this makes the point that most of the work in architecture to date has been technical. We have really an enormous body of knowledge about the design and creation of architectures using styles and patterns and tactics. We know how to evaluate and analyze architectures. We're starting to know how to test based on architecture. We have written a lot as a community about architectural reuse, especially in the venue of software product lines, architectures, particular domains, re-engineering, and recovery. It's all wonderful. This is an impressive body of work in a short time, but it's all about the architecture. And I think that as part of the continuing maturation of this field of study, it's time we start thinking about, as a community, the people that build architectures. Architectures are created by people working within organizations. How can we help them do what they do better? So this project about improving architecture competence is very much about the people side of architecture. Next, architectures are created by architects, and we'd like to know, how can we help them do their best work? What does it mean for an architect to be competent? How can an architect improve his or her competence? And architects work in organizations, and so we can ask the same questions at the organization level of concern. How can we help an organization help their architects do their best work? What does it mean for an organization that produces architectures to be competent? And how can an organization improve its competence in architecture? These are all questions that are worth pursuing, I think, and we're going to try to do that. Slide 8. What do we mean by competence? Well, it's not completely clear. One way we can look at this is that competent means that someone or an organization is capable of performing an allotted or required function. That's actually a very pleasing definition, because it lets us look at what architects do, and it lets us measure and improve what it is that they do. So a competent architect or architecting organization is one that carries out his or her or its duties competently. Now, duties may be hindered. Duties of an individual architect may be hindered by an incompetent organization. For instance, a competent architect, I would argue, would always insist on evaluating the architecture, running a formal evaluation step once the architecture is crafted. The organization may not support that. They may say, no, we don't have time for that. You're not allowed to do that. We don't support it. We don't give you the team for that. So we have to figure out, who do we chalk up that incompetence to? Do we blame the architect for not being convincing enough? Do we blame the organization? The answer is, I don't know, but we have to figure those things out. But anyway, in any sense, this gives us a way to evaluate architects and organizations in the here and now. We can watch what they do and measure how well they do it. So this is our going-in definition of competence. We'll have some more. We'll refine these as we go on. But for right now, a competent architect is one that carries out his or her architecture-related duties competently. Now, another way to think about this is that a competent architect is one that really produces high-quality architectures. And then we have to decide what we mean by high-quality architectures. And what we're mostly thinking is that high-quality architectures are one that are superbly aligned with the business goals of the organization. This gives us a way to measure the quality of those things and elicit the business goals and measure the alignment. So that's the end of the first section. And if there are any questions about the introduction right now, which was very brief and meant to be, I'll be happy to take them now. Great. All right, then moving on to slide 10, let's start talking about how we measure this. So what do architects actually do? If we're going to measure how well they do things, we need to figure out what it is that they do. Philippe Christian is an architect for whom I have a lot of respect, and he writes that he requires architects working for him to spend 50% of their time on the architecture. I realize my memory might be off. It might not be 50%. 70% or 40%, I forgot what the actual number is, but it was well under 100%. That surprised me when I heard Philippe say that. And my immediate question was, well, what do they do with the other 50% of their time? I mean, obviously, architects do more things than just create the architecture, but that low number surprised me. And so to help architects do what they do, we need to understand what they do. What are their duties? And what skills and knowledge made them, quote, capable of performing their allotted or required function, which was how we viewed competence going into this. So how can we find this out? Next. Well, actually, we can survey the community. We can find it out fairly straightforwardly. And so we've done this. When I was at IIT Mumbai last year, I had three very productive students working for me who did a fairly comprehensive survey of what I call the community. They did very long and detailed web searches, and they came up with three broad sources of information. We call these broadcast sources, education and training sources, and, quote, architecture for a living sources. The broadcast sources are information written by self-styled experts for mass anonymous consumption. So websites, for instance, blogs and essays. At the SEI, we collect duties of software architects. People write in and contribute what their duties are. I invite all of you listening to do that. Go to our site and tell us what the duties of an architect are. And books on software architecture. So these are the broadcast sources, sort of point sources that are meant for mass consumption by anonymous consumers. So my students looked at 16 websites. They found 16 blogs and essays about architecture. They looked at the tables of contents of the 25 top sellers on architecture on Amazon.com out of a total of some 75 books. Can you believe there are 75 books on software architecture you can buy at Amazon.com? I was astounded. The education and training sources, these are sources of information meant to be consumed by people sitting in a classroom, and mostly university and industrial courses. We found 29 university courses in software architecture, 22 industrial courses, and 7 certificate or certification programs. And finally, architecture for a living sources. We looked at position descriptions for software architects. I thought my students had an inspired idea. They said, let's go to all of the Fortune 150 websites, and we'll go to their hiring section. And if they're hiring software architects, we'll look at the position descriptions. We'll look at resumes of software architects who want to be hired. And let's give questionnaires to practicing architects. And we've got some 30 of those. We haven't yet added the data from those questionnaires to the survey, but we plan to do that soon. So those are the sources of information that we have. On slide 12, you can see an example of a course description. Here's a course from our friends at Bredemeyer.com. So here's a course. This is an industrial course, so this would be one of the education sources. The duration, 4 days, cost, and so forth. So let's see, you can see in the first bullet there what the topics are. So meta-architecture, architectural patterns, modeling, UML, and so forth. We would count these things as things an architect would be expected to know, so we would put this under the knowledge category. On slide 13, you can see an example position description. On the left, in red, you can see a lot of the duties that whoever wrote this position description expected. Define the architecture, provide technical direction, evaluate new technological development, and so forth. This was from Emphasis. It was dated May 3rd of last year. Over on the right, this same position description lists a lot of experience and skills that they expect in their architects. And so my students wrote all those things down. On slide 14, you see the survey results to date. We've surveyed over 200 sources, and we've cataloged 201 duties that the sources we surveyed said an architect should be able to do. 201 duties. That's a lot. 85 skill areas and 96 knowledge areas came out of this. So architects are special people. They need to have a lot in their heads, a lot of duties that they need to do well, a lot of skills they need to master, and a lot of knowledge areas that they need to have at their disposal. Next. I want to talk a little bit about the survey approach before I tell you the results of the survey. I like it because it cleanly avoids definition wars about architects and architectures. We don't have to stake out a position on what architects do and know. So I don't have to get six smart people in a room and say, all right, write down everything an architect does, because a different six people come up with a different list. The community tells us. And actually, for many of these sources of information, we can do fairly comprehensive searches. So if anybody has an architecture course on their website, we're going to find it, and we'll catalog it. We can catalog as many position descriptions as we care to, so there's no shortage of information doing this survey approach. We don't care what career path a person has taken to become an architect. As I'm sure all of you know, architects take many different paths to get to the station of becoming an architect. Some of them volunteer for it. Some of them just find themselves doing it suddenly one day, and others have greatness thrust upon them, as we say. And we don't care. The survey is impartial about that. And finally, it's systematic. As I said before, given a kind of source, we can go take a meaningful sample of it. So I like the survey approach. Next. It wasn't always easy. There are some challenges of this approach. So we encountered a bewildering variety of job titles. We saw IT architect, solution architect, software systems architect, enterprise architect, Java architect, middleware architect, platform architect, enterprise architect. Oh, I said that twice. I'm sorry. Even something called a code architect. This made me gag. But the lesson here is that there are a lot of different kinds of architects. These job descriptions are not well defined. And every once in a while, we would encounter a position description where the term was architect. But whoever wrote that was clearly using the term only as a prestigious title for coder. You look at what the duties, and it was just coding. It was just programming. God bless coders and programmers, but that's not architecture, and so we did not include those. We also made a conscious decision not to include enterprise architect in our survey. That's another survey, and maybe we would go back and do it and add it one day. I'm not sure, but I just want to let you know that for now we did not include enterprise architects. I feel that's a slightly different beast. Assigning data to categories I thought would be a challenge, but it turned out to be easy. If it's something that you do, it's a duty. If it's something that you are, it's a skill. And if it's something that you know, it's knowledge. We counted experience, by the way, as knowledge. We could have made that a separate category. Some position descriptions talked about specific levels of experience, but since other sources did not talk about experience, really, so no course really talks about how much experience you need, we decided to lump experience under knowledge. And finally, we had to decide how to handle very similar entries. So one source would say that the architect has to document the architecture. Another source might say the architect has to write down the architecture. Well, we don't want to count those as separate things, really. It's obviously the same thing. And so what we did is we treated every contribution as unique, we captured them all, and we used an affinity exercise to clump similar things together. Next. An affinity diagram is an exercise originally developed by Hiro Kawakita, who was an anthropologist. And the purpose of this is to discover meaningful groups of ideas from a list of raw data. Kawakita's idea is to examine the list, have people, experts, informed sources, examine the list and let the groupings emerge naturally using the right side of the brain rather than following a preordained categorization. So the steps are to assemble your team. And in this case, it was my three students and myself. Then we write the individual statements on note cards. So my guys wrote all the duties, all the skills, all the knowledge on note cards, and we stuck them on a big table. And then you play shuffle. So without saying anything, the team members will take two pieces of paper and they'll sit them next to each other if they think the contents should be grouped. Other people or other members of the team can come along and add to that group or undo it as well. And when the chaos settles into order and everybody looks at each other and nods their heads and say, yeah, I think we got it, then you've got the groups. And then you assign a name to each group and then cluster the groups. We ran three affinity diagram exercises, totaling 8 hours over 3 days. One exercise for duties, one exercise for skills, and one exercise for the knowledge that was collected. Next. Slide 18 shows an example of some of the duties we collected. So these happen to be duties related to documentation. So thoroughly understand and document the areas for the system that will be built. Prepare architectural documents and presentations. Document software interfaces. You can see all of these things, and these are the actual words that we found in the various sources. All of these things have to do with documentation, and so documentation emerged as a cluster of duties. Slide 19 shows the duty clusters that we came up with. So one duty cluster on the left are the major clusters, and on the right are the subclusters. And in fact, we did the right ones first, and then we grouped the clusters into major categories. So you see that architects have, from this exercise, from our data, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 major areas of work that they have to do. Obviously, if you ran the affinity exercise with the data, you might come up with different clusters, but these are ours. So, of course, the first thing they do is architecting. Well, I'm certainly happy the survey showed that. I would have been a little worried if it hadn't. But they also have to work in life cycle phases other than architecture, according to the data that we collected. They have to work in requirements and testing and coding and development. They have to do technology-related duties. They have to interact with stakeholders. They have to do management or interact with management. They have duties that are organization and business related, and finally they have duties that are involved with leadership, setting the technical direction, and team building, and running teams, and so forth. Slide 20 shows the relative weight that the data assign to each of these major categories. So let me show you how to read this chart. First of all, you can see that it's color-coded, and each color stands for an information source. So the dark blue is the training and educational sources of data, the pink is architecture for living sources, the yellow is the broadcast sources of information, and the light blue is the average of the three. So what this says is that each of these sources had certain things they had to say about architects and architecting. So every source said 100% of something. So we counted up how much they said about architecting, how much they said about life cycle phases other than architecture, and so forth, as a fraction, as a proportion of everything that they had to say. So each of these curves, if you add up all the data points, should add up to 100%. So for instance, the broadcast sources, I'm looking at the topmost left point. I'm sorry, the training and educational sources, 46% or 47% of everything they had to say was about architecting. Whereas if I follow that dark blue graph all the way over to the right-hand side, only about 6% of everything that source had to say was about leadership and team building. So you can kind of get an overall sense of what the community thinks is important here, and of course architecting is pretty important. Sure, the x-axis is not numerical. The x-axis is just categories, and so this isn't really a graph. I could have shown a bar graph, I think, might have been another way to show this, except it would have been hard to show the four curves or the four sets of data overlaying each other. So what's important about this graph is the points on the graph and not the lines that connect the points. On slide 21, it's the same thing, except here are the subcategories. Here are the subclusters of each category. So let's look at the far left subcluster: creating an architecture, evaluation analysis, documentation, working with architectures of existing systems and transforming those, and then an overall category that was not more specific than that. And again, you can see what the data showed. So there's a spike about architecture evaluation and analysis from the training and educational people. There's a lot of teaching out there about how to evaluate and analyze an architecture. The architecture for a living people, that's the pink curve, they didn't talk about that so much. You can see that their curve goes down under that point. Also, requirements is talked about a lot by the training and educational people. You can see there's a spike there in the second cluster, and so forth. And look over on the 1, 2, 3, 4 in the fifth cluster, program management. Look at that big spike. And in fact, the architecture for a living sources, it spikes up to around, I think it was 18 or so percent. So about almost one-fifth of everything that source had to say about architecture was about management, which I thought was interesting. On slide 22, there are some, I have to say, random observations about duties. These are just things that stick out at the graph. This is not a systematic analysis. But none of the subcategories seems to be considered of paramount importance by any of the source groups. Everyone agrees that architects do a lot of different things. We all know that. We all knew that. And this survey verifies that, and so it gives us some confidence in its fidelity. Project management, requirements, evaluation, and analysis are overall the most mentioned duties. The curve corresponding to the broadcast sources seem to hit the average. So the overall curve, that is the average curve, almost overlaps with the broadcast source curve. So the books and the blogs and the websites, they seem to be sort of in the middle of what everybody is saying. If you want to average it all, you go to the broadcast sources and they'll tell you. I noted already that the training and education sources produce a noticeably different profile. So maybe that says that that I'm not sure about this, but maybe the training and education people are a little bit out of sync with practice. Or I can turn that around. Maybe the people who practice are out of sync with the training and education people. It's an interesting gap that might bear further scrutiny. I think that's about all I want to say about this. On 23, let's move to skills. So here were some skills that we learned architects should have by surveying these sources. They should inspire creative collaboration. I love that. I don't know how an architect does that, but God bless them. You know, that's one of the things they need to be able to do, according to this survey. They need to have interpersonal skills, interviewing skills, investigative skills, leadership, learning, listening, constructive working relationships, mentoring, negotiation, and so forth. You can see that it's all over the map here, and this is just, again, an example of some of the exact phrases that we uncovered. Slide 24 will show you how we clustered these skills, how we affinitized them using the exercise. We thought we saw a lot of communication skills, and we broke that down into outward communication skills. So the architect has to be a good writer, has to be a good speaker. Inward communication skills, which basically means being a good listener, and then both or unspecified. The architect has to have interpersonal skills, so within a team, with other people outside the team, being able to show leadership. The architect has to have good work skills. This broke down into effectively managing a high workload. Architects are busy people with a lot of demands on them, and they need to manage that. They need to have skills to excel in a corporate environment and skills for handling large amounts of information. And finally, personal skills. So personal qualities, skills for handling the unknown, skills for handling the unexpected, which is slightly different, and then skills for learning. I just want to distinguish interpersonal skills from personal skills. We said that personal skills are what you could observe about a person if they were all by themselves on a desert island. But interpersonal skills are how a person works with another person or other people. So that's the distinction between those categories. On slide 25, you can see how the data broke down, again, in terms of emphasis paid to each thing. Look at that. Everybody, every single source we surveyed, every single category of sources that we surveyed agreed precisely. 20% of everything they said was about communication skills. You can see, in fact, these curves are pretty close together. Work skills rated around 35% to up to 39%, and finally personal skills ranked, that was where the spread was. Now, I think it's interesting that the Architect for a Living sources paid the least attention to personal skills. I'm not sure what that means, but I'll just observe that. Slide 26 shows the same data for the subcategories. And again, you get pretty fair correlation here, I think. What's interesting to me about this graph is the communication, inbound communication. So it's the third column on the bottom. Almost nobody wrote about that. Almost nobody wrote about architects being good listeners. In fact, the Architect for a Living sources barely mentioned it at all. I think that might be a 0%. I don't think that's even a 1%. They didn't talk about it at all. Nobody did. The Architect for a Living sources, on the other hand, look where their curve, the pink curve, look where it peaks. 20% of everything they wrote about was leadership skills. Whereas, for instance, the Educational and Training sources, they only talked about that half as much. They only devoted 10% of their bandwidth to talking about leadership. So architects apparently think they don't need to listen, but they do need to lead. I found that interesting. Slide 27 has some of these observations and more. All the curves agree on communication. Architect for a Living sources mentioned personal skills the least when compared with other skills or with other sources. At the same time, they place the most emphasis on work skills. Let's see. Here I think we saw a big divergence between the training and education sources and the Architect for a Living sources. Maybe that tells us, again, there's a gap between teachers and practitioners. And I'm making no claim about who's on the correct side of that gap, or perhaps the right place to be is in the middle of that gap. We don't know. Overall, leadership skills and skills for handling the unknown are the two most often cited. I thought that was interesting. And finally, as I said, Architecting for a Living sources give maximum weight to leadership and minimum weight of skills to handling the unknown. Now, maybe they just assume that. Maybe they just go in and say, well, obviously you have to handle the unknown. It's not even worth writing about. So all of these observations are subject to various interpretations, but I'll just offer them for what they're worth. Slide 28, let's move to knowledge. Knowledge areas. Here are, again, just a random sample of some of the knowledge areas that we collected. Software architecture concepts. Yes, I would certainly hope so. UML diagrams, basic knowledge of software engineering. Specialized knowledge of software engineering. These probably came from two different sources, and it was also fun to see different people say either different things or say the same things different ways. Knowledge about IT industry future directions. understanding web-based applications, experience with web services technologies, business reengineering, industry best practices, testing, and so forth. It was really fun looking at the raw data. If anybody's interested in seeing it, I guess I wouldn't mind sending it out. But back under skills, I just want to recall something I forgot to say. One of the skills we noticed was that the architects need to have political sagacity. I absolutely loved that one. I have no idea what it means, but architects apparently need to have political sagacity. So we all need to go take political science courses, I think. Anyway, so here are just some examples of knowledge. And slide 29 shows how we clustered the knowledge data. Computer science knowledge, knowledge of technologies and platforms, and knowledge about organizational context and management. Computer science knowledge breaks down to architecture concepts. Yes, I'm very happy about that. That would have made me worry if we hadn't seen a lot of that in the knowledge required. But also knowledge of software engineering, design knowledge, and programming knowledge. There was a lot of knowledge required of specific technologies and specific platforms, and we broke it up accordingly. And finally, knowledge about organizational context and management, having to do with the domain, having to do with the industry, having to do with the enterprise, and then leadership and management knowledge, as opposed to leadership and management skills, which we had before. So slide 30 shows the data for the major categories. Pretty consistent among the curves, I guess. The broadcast sources, turns out they don't talk about computer science knowledge as much as the training and educational people do. And the Architecture for a Living sources are sort of right in the middle. Again, the x-axis, really not important. It's not quantitative. It's not numeric. What's important here is not the lines between the points, but the points themselves. So computer science knowledge is just a category, and 50% of the broadcast information was about that, and 52% of the Architecting for a Living sources information was about that, and so forth. Slide 31 shows the data for the subcategories as well. And again, you can see fairly good fit here, except for the very, very first subcategory, which is knowledge of architecture concepts. The training and educational sources, anybody who's building training for software architects talks a lot about architecture concepts, and I suppose we would expect that. So over 45% of all of their bandwidth in terms of their topic areas and things they say is about architecture concepts. Look, on the other hand, at the Architecture for a Living sources. 10% of what they say they want and what they say they do has to do with architecture concepts. I'm sorry, not what they do, but what they know, what they have to know is about architecture concepts. Now, again, this may be because of the nature of the sources. The Architecture for a Living sources may not feel the need to write about knowledge of architecture concepts. They may take that for granted. And so I think that probably explains a lot of the gap there. But then again, you see that the broadcast source, the yellow curve, and the blue, which is the overall, the average, they map pretty well together. So once again, the broadcast sources are sort of getting it right in terms of representing the entire community. All the sources, I'm on 32 now, all the sources consider computer science knowledge to be the most worth mentioning. Training and education weigh in the heaviest, and training and education sources and Architecture for a Living sources differ by 4 times when it comes to architecture concepts, and I think we've explained that. Although, who knows? The explanation is just speculation, and you may have a different explanation. Sources agree on knowledge of software engineering, industry knowledge, and general knowledge of technology and platforms. So there you go. So that is pretty much our survey of duties, skills, and knowledge of software architects. I'm on 33. Remember that the point here was to use this to help us learn about an architect's competence. So this work lets us propose a duty, skills, knowledge model of competence. So knowledge and skills support carrying out the duties. Competence, then, is carrying out the duties, having the skills, and knowing the knowledge. Next, the advantages of this is that it applies equally well to individuals, teams, and organizations. And that is our interest. We want to talk about competence of individuals, competence of teams, and competence of organizations as well. It straightforwardly suggests an assessment instrument. How well does an architect do the duties, possess the knowledge, possess the skills? How well does an organization get the duties done, have the knowledge, have the necessary skills to at an organizational level, and so forth? And it straightforwardly suggests an improvement strategy. Improve your duties, improve your skills, improve your knowledge in those places where they were found deficient. So I like this. It's straightforward and it's actionable. Now, the competence project at the SEI is very early, and so we haven't done this yet. We haven't formed an assessment instrument based on this, and we haven't formed improvement strategies based on this, but I think you can see the direction that it's going. Next. So the future work is to apply the model to organizations. By doing this, we wanted to carry out case studies and surveys of organizational excellence in architecture. What does it mean for an organization to be really, really competent at architecture? We'd like to go find some, and we'd like to see what it means. We'd like to see how organizations improve their architecture practices. When I was in India last year, spending a year at IIT, it was my great privilege and pleasure to visit some companies in India, in Hyderabad, in Pune, in Bangalore, and several of those companies I thought had very impressive programs in place to improve architecture competence, and I learned a lot from those, and we'd like to do some more, some follow-up work and do surveys of practices and so forth. We'd like to investigate team practices as well, which is an area we really haven't broached yet. And finally, we'd like to be able to assess past performance to find targeted areas of improvement. Next, so what might be an organization's duties, skills, and knowledge? All of the sources that we surveyed in the survey I just presented were about really individuals. But I think the model scales up. I think it works at organizations as well. So the list for an organization's duties may include hiring talented architects. That may be the number one thing an organization can do to increase its architectural competence. But it can do other things as well. Clearly, establish a career track for software architects. Make the position of architect highly regarded through visibility, reward, and prestige. Somebody sent me a wonderful paper a couple of months ago about how this actually worked for the French Navy in the 17th and 18th centuries. Before that time, the French Navy was not highly regarded. It wasn't very effective. And the French government decided to do something conscious about that, and one of the things they did was they made the position of what we would now call naval architect a highly regarded position. It gave them social status. They got invited to the best parties. They got seated at the best restaurants. They got paid a very good salary. And within a couple of decades, the French Navy was world class. And so I think the same thing might apply to the architect realm as well. Make the position clear, but also establish a clear statement of duties and responsibilities and authority for software architects. Many organizations we know don't do that, and so I think they get substandard architectures as a result. You can establish a mentoring program. You can start a training and education program. You can track how architects spend their time. You can establish a certification program, measure their performance, provide a forum where architects can get together and share ideas and share problems and share solutions and commiserate with each other. I think that's very important. I see a lot of organizations doing this. I think it's a great idea. You can put in place organization-wide development practices centered around architecture. We all know that the end game of architecture is to produce high-quality systems. And if the people who actually build the systems don't know what to do with the architecture, that's unlikely to happen. And so the architecture practices are going to be a lot more effective if you make the downstream practices work with them. Establish and empower an architecture review board. Measure the quality of the architectures produced. I think that's an open issue. We don't quite know how to do that yet. I visited one company that said they measure the quality of the architectures produced by the customer survey at the end of the engagement. And if the customer's happy, then it was a good architecture. That's probably the end game of what we do in business in a lot of ways, but I think probably there's room to establish a more finer-grained measure of what we mean by quality architecture over and above customer happiness. And finally, you might initiate software process improvement. This is just an arbitrary list that I've put together based on exposure to some organizations in India and in the United States. Raytheon, for example, is a major defense contractor in the U.S., and Rolf Seegers is a person who has taken the lead in their architecture program, and this list includes many of the things that he's done. and talks about in presentations. That's the end of part two. And so if there are any questions about the duty, skills, and knowledge investigation of this work, then that'd be a good time for that. Sure. Why do we take out enterprise architecture for this? First of all, I feel like enterprise architecture and pure software architecture are different beasts, and we were after software architecture competence here. Now, how different are they? Well, you know, at some level of consideration, they're not different. They're both architecture. They're both about finding structures of things and what the pieces of the structures are and how the structures relate to each other. But I really felt like the duty, skills, and knowledge of enterprise architects were going to be substantially different than the duty, skills, and knowledge of software architects. Maybe let me say that a little bit differently. They might not be different, but I think the emphasis would be placed differently. So you saw that software architects were expected to have enterprise knowledge, but in the scheme of things, it wasn't a major concern. I suspect that the profile for an enterprise architect would be much different. You'd have to have much more enterprise knowledge and maybe much less software architecture knowledge. And so while I think that we are certainly in the same field and we're in the same ballpark, I think we do different things, enterprise architects and software architects. And so I didn't want to commingle the data, basically. I think having a duty, skills, and knowledge survey for enterprise architecture would be a wonderful project, and I'd be delighted to do it, and I'd be even more delighted if somebody else would do it. But I think it would look differently. And if we merged the two, my expectation would be that we'd get sort of a flat line and that everything would come out in the wash and it would all look equal. So it was just a decision we made going in, and there's certainly no implication about, you know, whether we think enterprise architecture is more or less worthwhile. We didn't. It was a very, very, you know, sort of what you see, what you get survey. In terms of the job descriptions, we went to, as I said, my students had the wonderful idea of surveying all the Fortune 150 companies. God bless them. They went to 150 websites and went to the hiring section of each one and found all of the software architecture positions that they could find. We did not investigate who wrote them, just as we didn't investigate who wrote the books or who designed the courses. It was what it was. Yeah, good question. That is a very good question. So I think a software architecture can be high quality in ways unto itself. For instance, the software architecture can be well or poorly documented, which is a different measure than the quality of the software of the ultimately resulting system. I think an architecture can have quality in terms of its conceptual integrity and its understandability, which is different than the quality attributes of the ultimately running software. And so there are ways in which we can measure the quality of an architecture that will, I think, affect or maybe influence the quality of the resulting software, but are different measures. I have seen people argue explicitly that architects should be jack of all trades. And in particular, they should be able to recognize situations that they've seen before someplace else and then to be able to apply versions of that previous solution to the new situation. So I think architects, as I said, I think they're special people. I think they need to have a lot in their heads. Should they know about technologies? According to the data that we collected, the community apparently thinks that they should, and that they should know about a lot of technologies. But I think that's important. It would be hard for me to imagine an effective architect that did not know about the technologies that he or she was prescribing for use. But I think that needs to be tempered with non-technological information about design concepts, ranging all the way from design concepts and architecture concepts to working with teams and leadership skills. So architecture runs the gamut. I think the question might be, how many technologies do they need to know about? And that's a question I'm not nearly so confident I know the answer to. You know, they need to know about enough, but I don't know what that means. Super. All right. So on part three of this talk is about a different model for architecture competence. It's going to be a little shorter than what we've done before because it's even more preliminary. But I wanted to share with you really breaking news here in terms of what's going on. So part three is a human performance model for architecture competence. I'm on 38 now. So this work is based on the work of a man named Thomas Gilbert. He lived from 1927 to 1995, and he's regarded as the father of human performance work. And this is someone who has written a book called Human Competence, Engineering Worthy Performance. It was originally published in 1978, and in 1996, shortly after his death, they published a tribute edition, which is the same book, except it's got about 50 pages up front, where everybody and his brother writes about what an incredible human being Gilbert was. It's quite daunting to read, actually. It makes you feel not worthy to read the book. But it's a very readable book, actually, and if anybody's interested in competence, I encourage you to look at it. As I say, it's very readable. It's easy to find. And we looked at this book, and Gilbert proposes what he calls a teleonomic model of competence. He doesn't know anything about software, but he knows about manufacturing, he knows about industry, he knows about sales, he knows about people doing their jobs. And he proposes what he calls a teleonomic model. It's a word with Greek roots that he coined. We've dropped it. We just call it human competence or human performance. And Gilbert's thesis is that you should measure performance, not knowledge, and not behavior or motivation or skills. And so Gilbert takes a completely diametrically opposite approach to the duties and skills and knowledge model. He would say, don't look at what they do, look at what they produce. Don't look at what they know, look at what they produce. And so we thought this was very healthy for us to look at. So Gilbert writes, if I want to know if people are competent, I have to observe how they behave, don't I? My answer to such questions is a firm no. So Gilbert measures competence by only what they produce, only the value of what is produced, and not how they go about it. He tells a story of a man who got the contract to salvage lead bullets from a military firing range. And so the soldiers would hit a beach and they'd fire their weapons into the sand. And then later after the exercise, this man would go and collect all the bullets and salvage them and sell them. And so he had a team of trained people going out and doing this, and they would work in lockstep. They would sort of dig, shovel, sift, gather, dig, shovel, sift, gather. They do this all day long, and they found a lot of bullets, but they were very expensive. And so one day this guy fired them, and he replaced them all with a bunch of college students who were willing to work for much less money. But the college students were awful, according to this man. They wouldn't work in lockstep. They played games. They played their radios. They were out there. They took breaks whenever they want to. He thought they had no work ethic, and at the end of the day, he fired all of them. He said, you guys are awful. And then he realized that they had recovered three times the amount of bullets that his so-called professional team had. And he tried to hire them back, but they were all mad at him, and so they wouldn't come back. So anyway, he says that you shouldn't look at behavior, you should look at results. And he says that the worth of a performance, or the competence of a performance, is the value of the result divided by the cost to achieve it. This has interesting implications for architecture. What is the value of an architecture? And what cost do we have to achieve an architecture? Gilbert writes that Egyptian pyramids are monuments to useless knowledge. They had a huge cost, and what was their value, really? Not so much, except to the people who were buried there, and maybe arguably not even to them. He said the Arabic alphabet was a much more worthy achievement by this measure. And so it was a completely different philosophy, and we're pursuing it to come up with a human competence model of architecture competence as well. Next slide. So measuring worthy performance. The worth is the value produced divided by the cost to achieve it. But the value, the performance, is not just unidimensional. It's not scalar. Gilbert writes that it has the following dimensions, or what he calls requirements. I wish he hadn't used that word, because requirements mean something special to us, but nevertheless, there it is. So he says that performance has three dimensions: quality, quantity, and cost. So the quality is the accuracy of the thing that you've done or that you've produced. It's class. So it's comparative superiority. Is it in a class by itself? Is it something of a totally new class? And it's novelty. Sometimes novelty has value in its own right. An engine that gets 100 miles per gallon is novel, right? Probably we could argue that the World Wide Web architecture, when it was first produced, was novel, and it let people do things that they had never been able to do before. Quantity has to do with rate, timeliness, and volume. And cost is labor cost, material cost, and management cost. And we thought it would be really interesting to see if we could apply these dimensions to the worth of what software architects do. Next slide. Gilbert proposes... Please. Oh, I see. Okay, so Gilbert, give me a couple of slides, and we're going to talk about environmental factors and how they apply. Stay tuned. So on slide 40, Gilbert proposes something he calls a measurement and performance audit. Now, we're trying to create an assessment instrument for competence, and so this certainly looks like something that could be the basis for this. So here's Gilbert's measurement and performance audit for a cathedral building company. So there's a sales group and a production group and a purchasing group and so forth. And under production, there's a gargoyle carving group and an assembly group and a packaging group and so forth. And under the gargoyle carving activity, the activities include stone selection and tool preparation and design and so forth. And so Gilbert says what you should do is go to each one of these, measure the worth, measure the competence in each one of those, and then see where the biggest improvement is possible, and then go down that path and do the same thing. So we thought, again, it would be interesting to ask ourselves, how does this apply to architecture? Gilbert, by the way, is very convincing in that he says you can measure the worth of any activity. So his book, I thought, was wonderful because he said, let's measure the worth of poetry. You think, well, how can you measure the worth of a poet? And he said, actually, how to measure it is not the problem. He said there are many measures possible. You can take a subjective ratings. You can see how often the poet is reread, or the poem, I mean, is reread. You can measure its meter and verse. You can see how many times it's cited. You can talk about the sales. There are many ways to measure the worth of a poem. He says, obviously, in many cases, you can't measure the behavior of the poet. They're dead in a lot of cases, and so we're left with just measuring the result. So that gave us confidence that we could measure the worth of architecture and architecting as well. So how do we apply this performance audit to architecture? Well, that's essentially what slide 41 asks. How to apply this to architecture? What goes in the boxes? And slide 42 gives us the answer. We know what architects do. We know what the tasks are that architects have to perform. We have that from our duties, skills, and knowledge survey. And so we just filled in the boxes that way. So architecting, other life cycle phases, technology, and so forth. These are the duty boxes. Under architecting, there's creating, evaluation, documenting, and so forth. And then we could diagnose problems based on where we find most measures of improvement. So on 43, then, here's our game plan for how to build a competence model based on human performance. First of all, we identify what worthy performance means for each task involved in architecture. We identify what costs are involved for each task involved in architecture. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. So if I'm documenting, if that's my task, what does worthy performance mean? If I'm evaluating the architecture, what does worthy performance mean on that? And then what are the costs involved in each one of these things? Then we're going to identify measures. So if I know what it means to turn in a worthy performance for creating an architecture, how do I measure that? And then we're going to identify an exemplary measure, the best we could hope for each one of these things. We're going to take the ratio of what we observe to the exemplary measure and then find out where the most capacity for improvement exists. And finally, building an assessment instrument. Once we've done this, let's pretty straightforward. The assessment instrument will go into an organization, gather measurements, compare them to the exemplar, and identify the best potential areas for performance improvement. Well, assessment is not the end game here. Improvement is the end game. And so once we've identified an area for improvement, we still have to suggest specific improvement strategies. We have some ideas about that. And for us, on our project, this is farther in the future. But let me just give you a sneak preview for how this is going to look, and here's where environment will come in. So on slide 44, this is Gilbert's behavior model showing improvement opportunities. Gilbert says that behavior is about acting in an environment. It's basically a response to a stimulus and then receiving feedback based on your action. So Gilbert divides the world up into two parts, environment and the person's own repertory of behavior. Environment includes data that you give the person, so feedback about what the person is supposed to do, how well the person is supposed to do it, what steps they're supposed to take. Instruments are tools and materials designed to match human factors, so in our case, do you give the architect the right environment? And then incentives, financial, non-monetary incentives as well. And all those are outside the person, but inside the person, Gilbert talks about knowledge, capacity, and motives. Knowledge is what the person does with the data. Are they able to internalize it and put it to use in order to turn in worthy performance? Capacity is how well the person is suited to do the job innately. And the things listed under capacity are some of the things you can do to maybe improve that. And finally, the motives of the person. Do they want to do this? Do they want to work? Gilbert says that capacity and motives are probably not where we should begin trying to do improvement. If the person has capacity problems, then we hired the wrong person. And if the person has motivation problems, maybe we just haven't incentivized them as well. Gilbert says people are motivated to do well, but we need to incentivize them. And he says that saying someone doesn't have the capacity is typically management's way of glossing over the fact that they hired the wrong person, or they haven't given them the right environment, or they haven't given them the right data. He says saying that a person just isn't motivated is management's way of ignoring the fact that maybe they haven't given them the right incentives. And so Gilbert really doesn't suggest that we turn our improvement lights onto those two areas. He says, first of all, let's give them better data. Let's make sure they know what they're supposed to do. He talks about just putting sets of instructions, taping sets of instructions next to machines. And he says that often turns in much, much, much higher methods of improvement, performance improvement, just sending a set of instructions to the person, giving them the right tools and materials, giving them the right incentives. Eventually, he says, we'll get around to increasing their knowledge, which is training. He says training is very effective, but it's also very expensive. And so you might not want to start there. So again, this is in the future for us, how we will apply this improvement strategy to architecture. I just wanted to give you a peek ahead. But on 45, let's remember what the immediate game plan is. It's figuring out what worthy performance means for each task involved in architecture. So on 46, let's pick one. So creating the architecture was one of the tasks that an architect has to do, and it's a task that we should be able to measure the performance of, measure the worth of, and therefore the competence. So does accuracy apply to creating the architecture? Well, we think it does, and it means, is the architecture the right one for the task at hand? That's what we think accuracy means in the setting of architecture. Well, how might we measure that? There are lots of ways. Here's one. Measure the total cost of changes to the architecture during development. So this will account for lots of small changes as well as a small number of big ones. Cost means the cost of making the change in the architecture and the cost of downstream resulting changes. So the thinking here is that if you have to make a lot of changes to the architecture, then it wasn't the right one. Its accuracy was off. If you didn't have to change the architecture, then it wasn't off. Well, how much was it off? Well, it depends. You know, how much did it cost you to make the changes? If a lot of little things were wrong, then that's going to add up. If a few big things were wrong, that's going to add up. We thought that the cost of architecture changes over the life of the project might be a good measure of the accuracy of the architecture. We would measure this as a percentage of the total cost of the system so that we could compare different projects. Now, this doesn't help. This is a poor measure in the sense that it doesn't help for changes that were just too expensive to address. So, for instance, if the architecture was so bad that the management says, well, I'd love to make these three changes, but we have absolutely no hope of doing so, then this measure won't capture that, and we'll need to come up with others. An alternate measure is to capture satisfaction of important requirements, test fulfillment, and so forth. Does class apply to the task of creating the architecture? In other words, is the architecture in a class on its own? Well, what might that mean? Maybe it might mean how many architectures were influenced by this one. And if they were, was the whole thing influenced, or did it just take pieces or ideas over? If this was an influential architecture in other systems, that might suggest that it had the class property. We felt that the novelty property didn't apply to creating the architecture. Creating a novel architecture just for the sake of novelty, not really a goal. I'm all for innovation, but only guided and directed and useful innovation, not just innovation for its own sake. Quantity or productivity, we can measure the time to completion, we can measure whether the architect met the deadlines, and we can normalize over the size of the system or maybe the cost of the system. The cost measures, labor, material, and management, I think those are pretty straightforward to measure. And so if we measure then these measures of creating the architecture, divide them by the cost, we should have a number that says what is the worth contributed to the enterprise by the architect in creating the architecture. Slide 47. The next task, or another task that we're thinking about, is architecture evaluation and analysis. This was one of the duty clusters that came up, and we at the SEI certainly believe it's really important and that you should evaluate an architecture. So what does it mean to have to turn in a worthy performance in terms of evaluation and analysis? Well, so under quality, does accuracy apply? We think accuracy in evaluation means, first of all, did you do it? But then accuracy means, did you do it right? Did you do the right evaluation? So did you miss any problems that came up later? And what were their severities? How do you measure this? Well, we could measure the cost of changes to the architecture and downstream changes that went undetected by the analysis. That might tell us how effective or how accurate the analysis was. Class and novelty, we didn't think applied. Rate, timeliness, volume are, I think, straightforward, and cost is pretty much the same thing as before. On 48, here's the last example I'll do. Documentation is an important task that architects have to carry out. What does it mean to turn in a worthy performance in documentation? Well, accuracy could have to do with errors discovered in the documentation. We can measure how or how much people used or relied on the documentation, how many times has it been referred to, how many changes has it had to undergo, and so forth. The class could be utility. This was really good. It was a great document. It was a lousy document. Read it and rate it. Novelty, we didn't think applied. Rate, timeliness, volume all have, I think, straightforward measures, and cost would again be labor, management, and materials, just like the other things, and we can measure those as well. So that's what we're thinking about in terms of building a human performance-based model of architecture competence. It's based on the value of the result. I like this model because I think it will finally help us answer the question which has dogged architecture for a long time, and that is, what's the value of an architecture? I think we're going to find out. I think we have ways to find out what this means, and by measuring the worth of the architecture activities and by measuring the cost, taking the ratio and saying this was the contribution of architecture to the project. So again, this is very early work. It's work in progress. But I thought it might be interesting to share work in progress with the group so you can see our thinking. We're certainly interested in feedback. That's the end of the third segment. And if there are any questions, now would be a good time before I move on to the conclusions and wrap up. Yeah, you know, I actually think I'm convinced by that. As I was talking about it and mentioned the World Wide Web architecture as an example of a very novel architecture that let people do things they had not been able to do before, I was thinking that I think I just talked myself into novelty being an important quality. So I accept that. You convinced me. Now, the question is how to measure it. How do you measure the novelty of something? And I don't know. I don't know. I think that's going to be a challenge, but one that we'll try to address. Yeah, isn't that a great question? Boy, yeah, isn't that a wonderful question? Because we all, and everybody who's a member of this organization, believes innately in its value. And the question is, how do you measure it? And then what I really keyed on in that question was, how do we get a seat at the table? And so I think one of the things that we're going to illuminate when we talk about the competence, the architecture competence of organizations, is, do you give the architect a seat at the table at the right time? You know, or do you say to the architect, all right, here's the system, good luck with that, let us know when you're done. Those are two very different organizations, and I fully expect that this work, when we assess the competence of an organization, is going to include that as a factor. How do you treat your architects, not only professionally, but how do you treat them on the project? When do they get to have their say, and when do they get to start contributing? Yeah, that's a good question. We talked about that when we were coming up with the measure that suggested that for architecture accuracy, we were just going to measure the number of changes that happened downstream to the architecture. And we said that. We said, what happens if the architect gets the wrong requirements? And we came up with two answers to this, and I'm not sure you're going to like either one of them, and I'm not sure I like them either, but it's our thinking today. One is, the first answer is that architects really are expected to have domain knowledge, and they should, part of their duties, part of the expectations we have of architects, is that they should have some insight into the requirements, and they should be able to sniff out, in some cases, requirements that are unreasonable or wrong or not what the user wanted or not what's going on in the domain. And the second answer, and I like this one a little bit better, is that when we compare their worth of an individual's performance to the exemplar, then the exemplar is going to have to deal with that too. So the exemplary case, the very best case of getting the architecture exactly right, is probably going to deal with wrong requirements as well. And so we thought that effect would basically wash over everybody equally, and that we wouldn't end up penalizing an architect for getting the wrong requirements. Yeah, that's a good question. And all I can tell you is that what our survey showed is that work skills rated the most. If you look at the graph for architecture skills, work skills were the highest rated. So about between 35 and 40% of everything everybody had to say about skills had to do with work skills. And these are things like effectively managing workload, skills to excel in a corporate environment, skills for handling information, and so forth. I think personal qualities and leadership skills are important as well. I don't know how you go about getting those. Some courses exist for some of these things, but I think a lot of them come with experience as well. So I would, if you're interested in skills, you know, as opposed to knowledge or as opposed to duties, I would go look at those things. But in terms of how to become a better architect, I would make sure that you're very comfortable with all of the duties that we talked about in terms of the clusters, and that you're also very comfortable with all the knowledge areas as well. And those things are, I think, much easier to improve. You can do the first with practice, and you can do the second with training. Yeah, right. So about architecture being business domain specific, I guess I think an architecture, at the end of the day, needs to produce a system so that the architecture and the system aligns with the business goals of the organization. And I think if you've done that, I think you've done your job. And so to the extent it needs to be specific to that, it depends on what you mean by specific. And I guess that's about all I can say about that. The second part of that question is very interesting to me, because I think those different kinds of architectures and the different kinds of architects that produce them is interesting. And the differences among those architects may be as big as what I said the difference between enterprise architect and software architect was. And so in a perfect world, I would go back and I would survey those different kinds of things. I heard something very telling when I went to visit an IT service organization one time. I said, "Tell me about your architecture." And they said, "Well, our architecture pretty much consists of deciding whether we use SAP or Oracle. And that's our architecture decision. That's the big one. And once we do that, then everything else falls into place." You know, so that kind of architect is very different than the architect who's building designing the software for, I don't know, the latest next generation fighter aircraft. So it would be interesting to go back and see these differences. I still think that the duties and knowledge and skills, I suspect, apply. I think the model still works, maybe in slightly different profiles, but I also think that the assessment will work as well. Measure the value, measure the worth of the contribution, divide it by the cost, and compare it to an exemplar. Great, okay, so on 50 begins the conclusions. I've only got 3 or 4 more slides. We're almost done. Thank you guys for hanging in. Our mission for this project is to help individuals, teams, and organizations measure and improve their competence in architecture. It's very early. I don't have any results yet, besides the duties, skills, and knowledge survey, which I think is interesting and will inform the work. We're pursuing 2 major themes. One is the human performance model, which is informed by the duties, skills, and knowledge. So the duties helped us populate the audit sections, and the skills and knowledge are things that we can improve once we find areas of improvement that are necessary. So I think that's going to be very fruitful. We're also pursuing a second theme that I didn't talk about, and this is organizational coordination mechanisms. So we have a piece of research. Lynn Bass is doing this with some people at Siemens, I believe, and they're doing a piece of work that looks at how organizations coordinate among their pieces and parts. So we all know that the people work together differently based on where they are. If they're in the same office, they work one way. If they're down the hall from each other, they work another way. If they're on separate floors, separate buildings, separate countries, separate time zones, separate continents, they work differently. And so how they coordinate varies based on these things. And sometimes organizational coordination mechanisms, it turns out, has a profound influence on the architecture that's produced and how successful the architecture is. And so we think that's an aspect of competence. Again, this is very early research work. So we're pursuing those 2 major themes. There's also a 3rd one I didn't mention, which is organizational learning as well. But the project also involves other work in exploring the relationship between business goals and quality attributes, surveying the community, crafting assessment instruments, and pursuing case studies and competence improvement next. Gilbert gives us operational steps to prosecute architecture competence, which I really like, and it's going to be a method with a pedigree in industry at large. You define worthy performance, define measures, define an exemplar, gather, find areas of improvement, and identify strategies. This gives us a model for competence that has a solid pedigree, and our duties, skills, and knowledge survey directly supports the model. Next, I'd like to tell you about some coming attractions in this work. On May 14th through 17th in Pittsburgh, we're going to have a little conference called the Software Architecture Technology User Network Conference. We do this once a year. Software Architecture Technology is the name of the piece of work at the Software Engineering Institute under which all this work happens. And we have a conference for all of our subscribers, all of the people that use our technology, and it's welcome. You're all invited. We're going to have a working session at this next conference in May to try to fill out the model, try to fill out the competence model. What does it mean to have a worthy performance in architecture in each of the tasks under architecture? In June, there'll be an overview technical note coming out that will explain the work in detail and where we are. And finally, ongoing, we are circulating questionnaires for practicing architects. It's 4 pages long. It's less than 30 minutes. And this asks architects what they think their important duties and skills and knowledge are and what their organization does or should do to support them. And you're invited. If you'd like to fill out a questionnaire, send me an email. And finally, last slide, I'd like to just say who all is involved in this and give them their due credit. The members of the Competence Project are Lynn Bass, myself, Rick Kaysman, and Mark Klein at the SEI. And I need to give credit to my students at IIT Bombay, and the survey was carried out by Pragati Verma, Shivani Reddy, and Divya Devesh, three wonderful students who I wish still worked for me. And as always, you can read more at our website. So that's it. Thank you for listening.